Good morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on April 8th, 2025. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Altamirano Trosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Sarah DiVittorio, our Acting Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Danny Rich, Clerk of the Board, and virtually Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. So I'll begin by doing the flag salute. We'll be greeting you if you wish.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic, which it stands, one nation,
copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's room near the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda?
I have none.
Okay. Comments from the public is item one on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on the agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and person shall be recognized to speak from sign-up cards located at the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If you're joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star 9 if by phone. I'll call you on you to speak at the appropriate time. When you have called in on a phone, please dial star 6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or other materials to enter into the record, hand them to the deputy clerk. We'll distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. We'll start out with item one, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on the agenda? Please raise your hand. I'm not seeing any online and I'm not seeing any in the room. Okay, we'll move on to item two, our consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes for the special meeting of March 13th, 2025, the regular meeting of March 18th, 2025, and the special meeting of March 22nd, 2025. 2B, bid awards, professional service contracts and amendments. And 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Any hands up? Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
The electric system North Tower upgrades, when was that last upgraded? When it was built? Was it built in the 60s? I'm just curious.
I'm just curious.
Because it's needed an upgrade for years.
Yeah, I'm Sean Wiggins. I'm the project manager in the facilities department.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the original construction on that was 1959. The third and fourth floors were then added subsequently in 1969. Okay. And so most of these systems that are down there in the North Tower are dating back to that time.
I highly support the project.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no more questions or comments, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next, item three, our CEO General Manager studying for the briefing session. It's time for the board and our general manager to discuss some issues among ourselves and review the staff. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, commissioners. We've got some good stuff on the agenda today. We'll start with our media update and our own Aaron Sweeney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. Aaron Sweeney, manager of corporate communications. Here today to talk a little bit about the media report and some of the places we've shown up in the news lately.
Yeah. Hold on just a moment, Aaron. So I'm not seeing the same screen in Zoom for the audience as we're seeing. I'm seeing the welcome to our commission meeting, mute all devices.
Let's try it again.
There we go. There we go. All right.
Perfect.
No worries.
Apologies.
Okay. All right. We'll get here one day. Okay, so the North County office grand opening, we had a great event. Shout out to the engagement team who did a great job putting on the event.
Start over, I think.
Good. Okay. All right. Start over. All right. North County grand opening event. We had a great event with lots of customers that came out and really engaged with us. A shout out to our engagement team who put on the event. Just a lot of really good pub for everything that we're doing out there. Awesome facility. So all the tours, want to give a shout out to everybody who volunteered at the event. We had lots and lots of employees that really were out there talking about the amazing stuff that's going on at North County. So, it's some good coverage too. So Ever Herald did a story kind of leading up to it. Afterwards, London Times ever posted a story. Herald did a story as well. We were highlighted in the Arlington newsletter. Just overall, an amazing event. And really, really proud of everybody who took part in it. Next up, we had a little kind of issue with the city of Everett. We had a water main break, and that affected a lot of our water customers in the Lake Stevens area. Worked really closely with water to make sure we got messaging out on this. Had some reporter calls from the Everett Herald, Seattle Times, a few stories. Water did a fantastic job of keeping us up to date so we could talk to customers directly. They sent out some direct information straight to customers through robocall and emails. Luckily, that got fixed really quickly and didn't have a lot of issue with that. Just a few other things going on. Our own John Hoffman did a great job presenting on the Green Economy Roundtable for Economic Alliance. That was a couple weeks ago. Got some good pub in a couple of places in the media on that. With the rate increase going into effect on April 1st, had a number of mentions in a couple stories. Cairo did a story on us, Ever posted a story, just a number of little places just kind of reminding customers. And a lot of the same messaging we put out through the press release, they picked up and stayed with. Cairo also did some a TV hit on our scams, just kind of reminding customers. They got that from our social media. And then BPA in the news, I just want to give a shout out to Adam Cornelius, Joe Fino. They're doing a ton of work. They weren't mentioned in these stories, but behind the scenes, they're really working hard on this. And with BPA kind of out front, is obviously that really affects us a lot. So just wanted to give them a shout out. Publications, April is all about the Energy Block Party, with that coming up later this month. The Wire will be all about the Energy Block Party, and so is Current, which will be hitting mailboxes next week. And then I just wanted to mention for The Wire in March, we really focused on our app. And we usually get about 15 to 20 downloads a day of our app. And so with all that kind of attention we put out through The Wire, we were seeing that uptick to about 50 to 60 downloads a day in March. And actually, when we put out our electronic Wire on March 10th, it actually spiked to about 350, 400. So, you get to see that some of this stuff is really impacting customers, and they're seeing it and they're downloading our app, which is great. And then I wanted to really show off this video. So this is our newest TV ad. This will be showing up on a lot of the streaming services we do. So that's YouTube, some of the podcast streaming services. So it's kind of, you think of a podcast as audio, but there's actually a lot of video ones. So this ad will be showing up there. It'll also be showing up on social media like Facebook, Instagram. A ton of work went into this. So Krista Rasmussen gets a ton of love for this. She organized the whole thing. She shot it. She edited it. She did all the really, really hard work. Yeah, she did a lot of hard work. But I want to also thank Michelle Stein, Lynn Dickin and David Krueger. They actually played the squirrels and did all the dancing that you'll see. So that was a huge lift for them. And then we had a lot of support staff from customer service and our corporate communications team that actually helped with kind of wrangling squirrels day of. So a ton of work went into this. And it really highlights some of our areas around the county. So I just want to play it real quick.
While our dance moves might not win any awards, our dedication to supporting local communities is unbeatable. Shimmy your way to lower bills and stretch your energy dollar with PUD conservation programs and meetings. Connect to save money and energy with your trusted partners at Snohomish PUD.
So just fun, just really showing connection to community, really leveraging our squirrels, which we've done a really good job, I think, over the last year of using them on social media, using them in a lot of different ways to kind of show the fun side of the beauty.
Your squirrels sign model released.
Yeah.
Do they sign model release?
It's so at least warm for the squirrels, for sure.
I hope we do more of it. We did it one time, didn't we? And we kind of backed off.
Yeah, our hope is to really do a lot more of this kind of like showing how we're connecting to our customers in many different ways. And you know, with all the events that we're doing now, it's easier to do that.
Yeah.
And then finally, just a really fun, you know, kind of showing how when we get fun photos from our crews in the field, leveraging them on social media, had a ton of comments, upwards of 70,000 views. This was a really fun one. It was actually in the APPA newsletter, I think, a couple days ago. So just really great. And we couldn't do it without the crew sending these photos in. So
do these qualify for maybe?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I mean,
it's a great photo.
I think it's a Blue Ribbon.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe at the fair.
The fair, that would be cool.
Yeah.
That's it for me.
Any questions for Aaron or comments?
I have a comment or questions. Well, first of all, thank you for doing all this. This is amazing. And yes, the ribbon, the cutting ribbon, it was really nice. And thank you to all the people that were involved 100%. For the piece of communication, how we can prevent the scams for our clients.
Yeah. So scams is really one of those things where it's just, we often hear about scams through customer service saying we're seeing an uptick, and we'll just really put information out on social media. That's where Cairo picked it up. So we put out a post on social media reminding folks. We have information all over our website, like Connect Up. We were having Connect Up scams for a while. So we put some information on the website, really kind of talking about what customers can expect, you know, what our employees will look like, trying to help them with scams. Because a lot of times we are seeing that, and that's actually what triggered the latest scam, was folks kind of impersonating our Connect Up people, and they're going to the doors talking about advanced meters to try to do whatever. We don't know, right? But we just want to make sure customers know that our people will have PUD gear, they'll have ID, they'll have all that kind of stuff. So it's really just an education piece. And when we hear these upticks, we just try to get that information out there as much as possible.
So it's okay to say, if you want to know more about scams or prevention, something, go to our website or our social media channels or PUD and everything,
yeah.
Which is
100%. Yeah. We have dedicated information on the website about scams.
Okay. And how many cars do we send for the blow, the party that's coming?
Oh, postcards for the
postcards.
I think it's about 50,000 postcards, which we sent to the downtown Everett core. That's what we've done in the years past.
How did you target those?
By zip code. So okay. We do three zip codes, 9201, 9203, and 9205, I believe, which is right here in this downtown Everett core.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to underline what a huge success Ribbon Cutting is.
Yeah.
You know, it's phenomenal when you get customers from all of our service area who come out. The only sunny Saturday we'd had in a while to attend it, and people really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it there were so many people. I actually never really toured the facility. Don and I walked down the hallway at the end together about the tour because there were so many people to talk to and to meet. And so I just want to thank all the staff that organized it. Mm-hmm. Huge success, and all the staff that ran it.
Yeah,
the people that helped park and. You know,
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out Kelly Stepney, who did a ton of work. Yeah. Our team, the engagement team, was just knocked out of the park.
Yeah. And it was also very powerful, in my opinion, to have those mayors come, three mayors and ARBs, come out on a Saturday to talk and talk about how important this facility is for North County, and especially, you know, to help heal some of those potential wounds with closing an office, closing two offices.
Yeah, I think so. I think it shows really how much our work in the community is paying off. I think people are interested in energy. They're interested in the PUD, and I think you're seeing that with the crowds that are coming to these events.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway,
great work. And the goat story is fascinating. Those goats are very friendly.
I have a last comment.
Yeah.
For the TV ads, congratulations on that. I think it's a perfect channel to engage with our community. So are you thinking to do these ads only in English, or do you have, you are planning to do in other languages as well, perhaps in the future?
That's a really good question. Right now, they are only in English, but I think we're open to all that kind of stuff. So in the future, we could do them in Spanish and other languages.
Thank you.
All right. Great job, Aaron. Lots of good stuff. All right. Next up is our legislative update with Ryan Collins, who's here in person. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, speakers. My name is Ryan Collins. For the record, the district, the district's government and internal affairs specialist 3. And on those. Yeah, I was hoping Aaron.
Sorry, Tyron. Come on, forgive me.
Oh, you're good.
You have your electrical tape that
you've
got?
Yeah.
I guess.
That works. Perfect. Hear me now, right?
Yep.
All right. So we're here to present on the legislative key legislation report. Purpose of this presentation is to report on. Purpose of this presentation is to report on key state legislation and share relevant legislative updates for the commission. As always, I've left time at the end for any questions, but feel free to stop me at any point. We're officially through week 12 of approximately 15 of the 25 legislative session, which means there are less than 20 days until the end of the regular session. Since my last report, we've passed two major legislative events, the opposite chamber policy cutoff on April 2nd, when bills needed to pass out of their policy committees to continue being considered, and two, the introduction of the legislature's three biennial budgets, operating, capital, and transportation, just a little over a week ago. Today, April 8th, is also an important cutoff date, the opposite fiscal cutoff, when bills need to be out of their respective fiscal committees. So really what that's saying is we're rounding into the final corner of the regular session with floor action set to take up the remainder of the time. Beyond finalizing policy objectives for the session, the legislature and the governor are increasingly focused on state budget negotiations. So after running through our key legislation report, I'll provide a high-level overview of the current status of the budget. And with that, we'll jump in. Our first bill is HB 1253, which clarifies and expands how consumer-owned utilities may engage in joint use or limited liability company agreements. The bill adds language to current statute allowing Washington utilities to engage in agreements with non-Washington regulated entities, most applicable to out-of-state electricity generation agreements. As a hypothetical, were this bill to become law, the PUD could enter into a joint use contract with an independent power producer or customer generators to co-own and operate the generation facilities inside of Washington or outside of it. The most applicable projects that kind of come to mind at this point would be large-scale community solar projects. Since I last reported to the commission, the bill was narrowly amended to change the ownership requirements in the bill to be at least equal versus equal. This helps give greater flexibility in contracting to not require ownership to be exactly equal. On April 4th, the bill passed out of the Senate unanimously. For the commission's reference, since the bill was amended in the Senate, it must go back to the House for a concurrence vote where they agree to the changes before heading to the governor's desk for his signature. The PUD supported the legislation and will continue to monitor this bill as it heads towards passage. Next is HB 1329, which clarifies that energy purchase under long-term contracts with the Bonneville Power Administration are excluded from the no-coal provisions of the Clean Energy Transformation Act, also known as CETA. This bill is a priority of the power generation pool, of which the PUD is a member. The goal of the bill is to ensure that BPA's long-term preference contracts will not violate CETA's no-coal provisions. Since I last reported to the commission, 1329 has progressed through two cutoff dates and is now awaiting a vote on the Senate floor. Snohomish BUD has been closely involved in negotiations on this bill since its inception. We anticipate a small revision to the language that would add reporting requirements that the utility already accounts for related to average unspecified electricity purchases greater than 31 days. The amendment is likely to be added when the bill comes up for a vote on the floor, and we believe the negotiated changes should be the final piece to assuage all stakeholders. While nothing is ever certain, we believe this bill is likely to be signed into law. Next is HB 1610, which would have created an exemption in the Public Records Act for critical infrastructure information. Unfortunately, this bill is no longer moving forward as it didn't pass its policy cutoff. I do anticipate this proposal to be reconsidered next session.
If I may interrupt for just one moment. Critical energy infrastructure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Critical energy infrastructure information is exempt under the PRA based on a case. There's just not a specific exemption written into the law. So we can still withhold it if it meets a certain criteria. This would have just codified that withholding.
Thank you. And the Senate is, again, they want to hear a little bit more of exactly the importance of this. And so the Department of Commerce, which originally requested the legislation, has planned on doing a kind of robust education campaign with the legislature over the interim. And so again, we'll anticipate seeing this next year. Next is Senate Bill 5627, which would update several components of the Underground Utility Damage Prevention Act, also known as DIGLA. Washington law requires everyone from businesses to residential property owners to locate underground utilities before digging by calling 811. The bill would modify requirements related to locates and excavation of underground facilities, such as water lines and buried electric infrastructure. Since I last reported to the commission, there have been additional changes to the bill as it's moved through the House. Snohomish PUD has been engaged with the excavator community on the bill and has been working towards a product that can be acceptable to all stakeholders. The final area of difference between the utility industry and excavators were on the new provisions that would have allowed multiple contractors under a single notice. The PUD believed the new language didn't clearly state the liability for damages would remain unchanged to current law. As such, the bill was amended to remove those multiple contractor provisions until a compromise of the language could be achieved. Since I submitted this report on Friday, there has been a compromise, and the bill was amended just out of its policy committee to address the issue in a satisfactory for both utilities and excavators. Who agreed that the intent is to leave the liability unchanged from current. The bill now heads to the House floor.
So, you know, I originally assumed this was about shoring and things like that during excavating, but I imagine there already is laws about that. So is this really about the interaction of multiple utilities? You know, like when the cable company comes through my neighborhood and it's gas line or a water line, is it more about the interaction and the danger of those?
For the multiple contractor provision specifically. Yeah. So in essence, when you have a large site that's going to have multiple excavations at any point, the idea was to streamline the process to have multiple contractors under a single general contractor in some form or another. That was the intent behind it. And again, what we were concerned about is if you have a subcontractor who ultimately does an excavation and does damages, who's liable for that? And the language wasn't clear enough to say that it was not unchanged from current law, which again, we want to specify.
I have a question or comment regarding this bill. Do you think that this bill is going to create any potential cost or administrative impact to the utilities?
That's a great question. From our review, there's not a significant cost. More than anything, this is just updating the DIG law to incorporate new technologies such as positive response and other things. There probably are going to be some administrative costs associated with changing our processes to incorporate those things. That said, we don't think they're too burdensome.
Okay. Thank you.
Next is HB 1628, Next is Senate Bill 5466, which would amend, as amended, would establish a new independent state agency called the Washington Electric Transmission Authority, also known as WEDA. The bill would authorize the agency to be a public resource and support the expansion of additional transmission in Washington state. The bill also attempts to address the slow siting and permitting process by amending the State Environmental Policy Act, also known as CETA, to provide exemptions for certain transmission and distribution projects on already disturbed land. As the bill has moved through the House, the CEPA exemptions have been redefined to no longer reflect specific technologies, but rather focus on the geographic and status of the site. Moving away from definitions such as grid enhancing technology and towards definitions such as upgrading and rebuilding. These changes do improve the bill since it no longer would require specific assessments for the type of technologies under consideration and would focus more, focus the categorical exemption delineation to the project to be project specific instead of technological. Furthermore, the bill has been amended to clarify the timelines and responsibilities for categorically exempt projects as they relate to tribal consultation and involvement. While the bill continues to move forward, we are still anticipating more work to be done on it as it heads towards passage.
I have a comment about this regarding financial implications and the bill that you just speak about it. And
that
you are right now.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so from our read, we're not going, so this authority would be the one that would ultimately set up and build and develop and finance transmission lines. So they would not necessarily impact the PUD in a financial way. The CEPA provisions, again, if they would be, if we could find the categorical exemption for specific upgrades and rebuilding of our lines would save time and also funds, as that would be a quicker process.
Well, I can see that this bill is an opportunity to modernize our grid, but it will require a thoughtful collaborations and planning, and so.
Absolutely. I think that the authority is, it'll be interesting to see how the authority engages and collaborates and coordinates amongst the different entities in the transmission and planning space. Again, I think what we've kind of communicated is that there aren't too many challenges to financing and planning transmission. Again, the challenge is getting shovels.
Thank you.
So would this apply to our own transmission system or more for regional transmission?
So for the CEPA provisions or the
CEPA.
For the CEPA provisions as currently drafted, it would apply to distribution and transmission lines at 115 kV and above.
Which ours are?
I believe we do have some of them.
Yeah. We have some 115 transmission. Okay, that moves up our transmission. Right. Thank you.
Next up is House Bill 1409, which would modify the Clean Fuels Program under the Department of Ecology. The Clean Fuels Program was first established in Washington in 2021 with the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions for the transportation sector. The statute gives the Department of Ecology the authority to set a carbon intensity, also known as CI, standard for transportation fuels and requires all transportation fuels, fuel producers and importers to participate while electric utilities can voluntarily participate in the program. Under current statute, fuel with a carbon intensity below the CI standard generates credits, while those above the carbon intensity standard must acquire credits to cover their compliance costs. Currently, there is an oversupply of credits in the market, which has led to lower than expected credit prices. To counter those low credit prices, the bill would allow the Department of Ecology to reduce the CI faster than under current law, thereby reducing the number of credits available on the market and increasing the price. The PUD, which participates in the Clean Fuels Program, would benefit from an increase in credit prices, which helps to fund some of our customer programs eligible under the law. We anticipate this bill to also continue to be moving forward.
And I'm going to comment about this. I'm ignorant, but I can see the environmental benefits and perhaps maybe economic implications impacting mostly low-income and rural communities with this.
So are you referring to just the credit prices for us? So a higher credit price for us certainly means more revenue coming in to fund our customer programs, which again would be helpful for those populations that we're targeting.
You know what, John, Would anything that's done on the federal level supersede something like this, or supersede the existence of these programs? Or is this under state?
So this is currently under...
That question you can't answer. That's okay.
That's a challenging one, as it's a little speculative. There are obviously federal preemptions in certain instances. That said, states like California and Oregon also have clean fuels programs that have been are well established over the last decade or so. I don't anticipate that happening. That said, never say never. All right. Next is Senate Bill 5445, which would amend the Energy Independence Act to allow electric utilities more flexibility to meet the law's 15% renewable energy target. The EIA, enacted in 2006 after the passage of Initiative 937, required utilities serving over 25,000 customers to obtain 15% of their electricity from renewable sources or purchase renewable energy credits, also known as RECs, to cover the compliance gap. Under the EIA, hydropower does not count towards that 15%. So many Washington utilities, at least under the EIA, have more than 100% renewable generation. This bill, requested at the behest of the Washington Public Utility District Association, also known as WPUDA, would expand the statute to include a new list of projects defined as distributed energy priorities, as well as demand response and accelerated conservation programs as new eligible pathways to help the utility meet that 15% renewable energy target. Moreover, the bill was amended to include a quadruple REC multiplier for those projects from the enactment of this bill through the start of 2030. That means that instead of the 2x multiplier under the EIA that is currently in statute, projects are that are defined as distributed energy priorities, which include solar and batteries, wind energy storage, as well as microgrids, would be eligible for twice the amount of RECs. The Homish BUD also successfully secured specific language to ensure that the microgrid up in Arlington would likely qualify as a source of this compliance. And it is our understanding that as currently drafted, the bill would provide about $1.3 million in annual savings because of that addition. The bill received a public hearing this past Saturday and with the House Appropriations Committee, where the PUD testified in support. It's actually up for exec session, I think, as we speak. So we're looking forward to seeing this move to the House. Finally, we've added a new bill to the key legislation report, Senate Bill 5804. This bill would modify the state public utility tax, lowering the current tax rate from 3.6 to 1.7, and then adding a new public tax, public utility tax of a little over 2%, which would then be diverted to a new federal injunction salmon habitat, also standing for fish, restoration account. Resulting in a nearly equal rate assessment rate as assessed now. The funds collected in this new fish account would be used to securitize state bonds used to finance these culvert projects. For the commission's reference, in 2013, a federal court issued a permanent injunction on the state's transportation department, requiring them to improve or remove culverts that act as barriers to fish passage under state-owned roads. While the state has been making steady progress to finish this work and must do so by 2030, the remaining culverts are the most expensive and difficult to complete. Due to the increasing cost and difficulty, the state is not expected to meet this 2030 deadline for the removal of all these culverts. To make matters more complex, there is a growing budget deficit within the for transportation projects due to decreasing tax revenue from the state's gas tax. So SB 5804 aims to improve the state's transportation budget by removing this large liability, shifting it over to the capital budget, and using the PUT fund to swap the securitized and securitized for these types of projects.
I don't understand the link. When WASDOTs need to replace culverts, and taxing utility customers.
That was exactly the type of comment we sent into the legislature, saying that this, again, there's no link between utilities and these culvert projects. While we believe they do need to be completed and finalized, we would appreciate these funds coming from a more direct source.
And then what are these taxes used for now? So if they lower the tax rate 3.62 to 1.74, they're taking revenue from something. And I get where the 2.011 is going, but
As the bill is currently drafted, those funds go to, I believe, two different accounts. One is the it's just the general fund, and then the other is the public works assistance account, which also would then be diverted. There's been a lot of back and forth with the public works account over the last decade in terms of being diverted to different purposes and then refilled and back and forward. As of now, the public works fund would need permanent revenue to make itself whole, because you are correct, it is being diverted to zero account. As I mentioned, we did submit comments during public testimony last week, again, indicating that while the fiscal impact is neutral, we are concerned that the proposal would impose new future costs unrelated to the delivery of a utility service. And while we again do support environmental restoration efforts, we believe these costs should be borne by some source that is far more directly associated with the culvert projects themselves. For the Commission's awareness, SB 5804 is not required to follow the typical legislative timelines, since it's considered necessary to implement the budget. We'll continue to monitor this bill as it moves forward in conjunction with the state budget this session. Speaking of the state budgets. So now I want to move on to the current dynamics around that. I want to start off by providing a high-level picture of what occurs with the state budget, as it is a complex process involving multiple forecasts, three budgets, and many stakeholders inside and outside of the state government. For the Commission's context, the state budget is planned on a biennial basis, meaning every 2 years. Budgets are passed in the long legislative session, which is the first year of the biennium, and a supplemental budget is passed the following year, the last year of the biennium. Moreover, the state constitution requires the legislature to balance the budget every two biennia or every 4 years. The budget process kicks off when the State Economic Revenue Forecast Council issues a preliminary estimate prior to the start of session of what the state's tax revenue is going to look like. This aligns typically in November of the year preceding the session and is released alongside the governor's budget. Budget writers typically consider this information and then begin writing the outlines of the budget at the start of session. Those outlines are then updated and filled in after the state revenue forecaster provides an updated revenue estimate in March. The numbers on slide 13 here at the top are the most up-to-date estimates of what the revenue is looking like. Moreover, state spending... this year, revenues are estimated to increase, but at a slower pace than earlier estimates. Moreover, state spending is estimated to grow faster than revenue is if the legislature continues to keep spending at current levels. When you're hearing in the news that there is an estimated $13 to $15 billion shortfall over the next 4 years, that's what they're referring to, this growing gap between estimated tax revenue and estimated spending, which is even higher. As the Constitution requires, the legislature must balance this budget and can do so either by decreasing spending, increasing revenue, or doing some combination of both. Since budgets were released this last week, it appears that the legislature and the governor will enact some combination of reduced spending and increased revenue.
Are there some differences between the governor and legislature staff?
There are, yes, there are some significant differences. And we'll touch upon that. It's going to be
that bold and extended session.
I'm not here to jinx anything about a potential special session, but it doesn't happen, but it the tea leaves would indicate. Yes. So speaking specifically to the proposed budget, the state budget is again divided into three different budgets. The operating budget, which covers all programs and services that you typically believe or kind of associate with the state government. The transportation budget, which provides funding to all state transportation and for development and maintenance of state roads. And then the capital budget, which includes all physical infrastructure funded by the state. The top line funding levels of the proposed 25-27 biannual budgets are available on slide 14 here. As you can see, compared to the enacted 23-25 budgets, both the operating and transportation budgets increase spending while the capital budget decreases. I should note that these numbers are associated with the bills that passed out of their respective chambers and are likely to change as budget writers and the governor negotiate final spending behind closed doors. It comes as no surprise that these negotiations are going to be complex and challenging, given vying priorities for state funding and the potential for revenue increases, and how politically salient those increases are to legislature, the legislature.
Can I help?
Yeah.
So does any of this take into account the potential that that federal funding is going to be pushed back to the states? Does that, is that being taken into consideration?
There is, it depends on the account, depends on the area. There are certainly some areas like low-income assistance, particularly with LIHEAP, that the state has taken into account. Medicaid is another area that they're obviously very focused on. That said, again, I don't want to speculate too much, as these, you poke the balloon once on an area, it popped out somewhere else, and what that looks like at the end is still very much to be determined.
But some of it hasn't been.
Well, can you
use
the previous slide? So is there, I know it's, everything's happening quick right now with tariffs, but is there any conversation legislature that the economy may change, at least short term, and these revenue projections may be optimistic?
So I know Jenna Peth is online to talk specifically about tariffs after I get done here. This, I will say, from the state's perspective, the state forecaster does take into account the macroeconomic environment. And if you read into their forecasts, they do talk about the uncertainty that's kind of being unleashed with the tariff regime. That said, again, that was issued on March 18th, and obviously there's been 2 years since. Feels like 2 years since.
Yeah, no.
Can we jump to the next slide? Perfect. So speaking of revenue increases, both chambers have issued different proposals to help bridge this budget gap, although there is a general theme across both chambers. I've outlined the revenue proposals that are garnishing the most attention for your awareness. First is this new intangibles tax that would be levied on stocks and bonds and investment portfolios of individuals with high estimated wealth. The House proposal would levy an $8 tax on every $1,000 over that threshold, which I believe is $50 million. The Senate would do something very similar, but at a rate of $10 for every $1,000. As proposed, the intangible tax would not impact the PUD, since it is only assigned crafted towards individuals. Next is a business and operation tax for the House and a large employer payroll tax in the Senate. The House B&O tax would apply to large businesses as defined as making over $250 million in taxable income. And that would apply a 1% tax on all that income over that threshold. Since the PUD's taxable income doesn't hit that account or that threshold, this wouldn't apply to us. However, the Senate payroll tax would apply to the PUD. The tax proposal is based on a similar proposal that was recently implemented in the city of Seattle. The bill would add a 5% payroll tax to all employees, the large employer who make over $174,000 and would be paid by the employer. Large employers under the Senate bill would be considered any employer making over $7 million in total employee payroll expenses. I realize I said gross revenue here. It's actually just total payroll expenses. And there is little to no exemptions on what type of employer that would apply to. As for the impact of the PUD, we estimated to probably add about $1.4 million annually. Another proposal on the table is the removal of the cap on local property taxes, which would remove the 1% yearly cap and replace it with a formula based on the jurisdiction's population as well as tie it to inflation. Each chamber's tax would provide significant funds to state and local jurisdictions, which in turn lowers the fiscal constraints on the state budget. As for the impact of the PUD, the public utility tax is applied in lieu of property taxes, so any increase would not have a financial impact on the district either. These are just the high profile revenue proposals that have been introduced, but I should note that for the commission that they are not the only ones out there. And there's likely to be more considered as negotiations over the budget continue. And we'll continue to keep you guys apprised. Finally, and Commissioner Olson's point, the governor did weigh in back on April 1st, holding a press conference on the ongoing budget negotiations and setting up what we think is going to be a very interesting and lively policy debate. In short, Ferguson indicated that neither budget proposed by the state legislature is quote unquote, close to something he could sign, and laid out five priorities that must be met to receive his approval. First is that the state must continue to invest in the budget stabilization account, also known as the BSA, given the increasing uncertainty at the federal level. Two, any budget must be based on realistic growth estimates and not on the default revenue growth option of 4.5%, which budget writers have relied on in the past. And then three, there are this year is not the time for new investments, and the state should minimize those when and where possible. Four, the state needs to take advantage of significant efficiencies and savings, and those should be considered before any tax increases are, reiterating that taxes are the last option. He also continues to exempt K-12 public safety buckets from those costs or those cost savings. And then five, he said he will not sign a budget that relies on the untested revenue from the quote-unquote intangibles tax, which he's continued to indicate he has deep reservations on and believes will be subject to a court challenge. Cool. Needless to say, the next couple of weeks will be very interesting, so get out your popcorn. We'll continue to update the commission on the status of these negotiations, as well as kind of where the policy bills land in the next couple of weeks. With that, any final questions?
I have
no
question.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thank you very much.
Excellent job, Ryan. All right, we do want to take some time to talk a little bit about tariffs. We have Jenna Beth and Jeff Bishop. We're going to start with Jenna, who is in DC and is going to be talking to us virtually. Jenna, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much. Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jenna Peth, the Federal Affairs Specialist for the district. And this morning, I wanted to provide a brief update on recent developments in U.S. tariff policy that will have downstream implications for our operations. Last week, President Trump issued a national emergency declaration related to foreign trade practices, which triggered a new round of broad and country-specific tariffs. This declaration enables the president to impose tariffs unilaterally by bypassing congressional approval. As with previous tariff announcements from this administration, there is a possibility that some goods or countries will qualify for negotiated exemptions or petition-based relief. However, the administration has also signaled at this point that tariffs will remain a central part of its economic agenda going forward, which introduces uncertainty into long-term supply chain planning. Before I get into the specifics of the tariffs, I would also like to note that our own Senator Maria Cantwell is working with Senator Chuck Grassley and some other Senate Republicans on advancing legislation that would establish greater congressional oversight over tariff decisions. At this juncture, congressional action theoretically represents the most viable path to achieving a more consistent and predictable policy baseline on trade and tariff issues, but it will face significant political headwinds. In terms of the tariff specifics, as of April 5th, there is now a 10% baseline tariff on all imports from all countries. But starting tomorrow, April 9th, we're going to see an extra layer of added reciprocal tariffs. These will apply higher rates specifically to countries where the U.S. has significant trade deficits. There are some key exceptions to be aware of. A few important goods are exempt from the reciprocal tariffs specifically, including copper, semiconductors, and lumber. Additionally, the existing Section 232 tariffs haven't changed, so we're still looking at 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum and 25% tariffs on automobiles and auto parts. Another big carve-out is for energy products and critical minerals that aren't available domestically, but the definition of not available is unclear at this time. And looking specifically at China, an additional 34% tariff begins tomorrow. That's on top of the existing 20% tariffs that were previously announced. So there is now a total 54% tariff on Chinese goods. And finally, I wanted to provide a quick update on Canada and Mexico. After a bit of back and forth, the treatment of goods from those two countries is back to the USMCA or US-Mexico-Canada agreement status quo. That means about 70% of imports from Canada and Mexico are not subject to new tariffs. Goods not included in that agreement are subject to a 25% tariff. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to discuss the implications of these tariffs on the markets and our supply chains, and I'm happy to answer any questions at the end.
Morning, commissioners.
Morning. Don't touch it, Jeff.
Concerned about touching the Jeff, I'm the chief financial officer. Excited to talk to you about the impacts. I do want to commend Jenna and Kim for the work that they've been doing to keep us up to date hour by hour on what's been changing relative to the tariff topic. And I'll say that this has been intentionally followed by banks, by the financial community. Now, I'll summarize it a couple words just to say, you know, as we think about it, two words, visible and fluid. It's changing all the time, and you see that. What we don't know is kind of the duration and magnitude. So those are the pieces that I'm hoping to walk you through. From a short-term perspective, what we've seen is a pronounced impact both on the debt and the equity markets. You've seen that publicly. Equities up until this morning had dropped about 10% when we looked at the S&P 500 and the broader indices. Conversely, on the debt markets, we saw flight to quality. U.S. Treasuries were a good place to put your money if you're looking for a safe house. And so we saw a lot of money transferred in. That actually dropped the treasury rates, which because of the inflow of funds, roughly about 50 basis points. So for us, as it relates to us out in the marketplace issuing debt, that's a good outcome. Now, fast forward to this morning, everything changed. We've seen an increase in terms of the treasury rates and then also an increase in terms of a return on our equity. Longer term impacts, as we think about it, from a rates perspective, the Fed has signified they want to do two interest rate cuts this year. We just got an update from the Fed Chairman Powell on Friday. His position was we're going to wait and see. Why is that? As we think about it in terms of inflation, if we do see inflation coming on as a result of tariffs, which one would naturally think would take place, oftentimes you increase rates. Conversely, if we're in the middle of a recession, you oftentimes decrease rates. And so I think ultimately that's why he's in the position of wait and see. As we think about how that translates to our community, what does it mean in terms of the impact on households? Again, we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But there have been estimates put out there, $3,400 for the average household. Has been an estimate if we do see the tariffs come into play as designed today. And similarly, as it relates to the operating costs for the PUD, tariffs in place, we look on the aggregate base, are about 11%. Those are going up and reflected to go to 22% as currently put out there by the administration. Again, that impacts the long-term growth presumptions relative to what we're seeing in our community as well. In terms of an impact on operations, we do know that we will see some impacts relative to our critical materials. We expect to see longer lead times and a decrease in supply, both from domestic as well as foreign suppliers. The team's been doing a phenomenal job, our supply chain teams as well as our staff, to go out and specifically look at what are the critical materials that are out there. And there's been a lot of work that's been done to date to get us in a good position. Going back to COVID, so working back over the past 5 years, they've really worked to get our critical materials from 12 months in inventory to average of 24 months. So that provides us some good cushion in the event that we have a slowdown in the supply. The teams are actively working with vendors to figure out what the impact of tariffs will be on them. Similarly, they continue to look at multiple vendors. We've got almost 90% of our key materials are coming from multiple vendor sources. That helps to mitigate some of that concentration risk. I'll also highlight that PUD management is working to develop mitigation plans. So as we think about what's going on at the state level, what's going on at the federal level, there's a lot of headwinds coming our way. So working up mitigation plans, we look at the different scenarios that can impact the utility. What can we do to mitigate those impacts in terms of increased costs, lower revenues coming from slower growth? Those will be pieces that we're pulling together under John's management. The other piece I would say is just from a takeaway perspective, it's a little bit of doom and gloom right now. I will highlight that we don't know exactly what the impact will be. I will reemphasize the strong credit that we do have as a AA rated utility. That really comes in as a good baseline to pull from, especially when times are uncertainty, to be a good credit quality. And then I would just highlight also that the staff and management are working actively to mitigate potential risks that are coming our way.
Questions for Jeff?
Well, you mentioned about the the supply and the vendors and everything. So I'm wondering if all the tariffs going to impact in our products, because of course we have these commitments with different countries, right? So how that is going to be the slow process, or even though the contracts they are signed in place, I mean, that is going to change something. So I know that there are different questions that don't have answers right now because day by day this is changing, but we don't know how safe we are, right, and doing this. So.
Yeah. I'd say we're in good contact with the vendors, though, to get the real-time information that they're able to supply on that. So as they become aware of information that will impact their ability to supply, we'll be on that as quickly as possible. And then from there, since we've got multiple vendors, trying to figure out how do we balance that out. But again, it's changing minute by minute.
But besides the supplies, besides the money, or the it's going to increase or not, does the product's going to be on time or not? So that is another thing that with Ferrous, might impact the production chain, process, timing, money, so.
100%.
Yeah,
as Jeff talked about, Jeff and his team, both the finance team as well as supply chain, they're trying to look under or look at all the different scenarios and how they could play out. But we also, things like our AMI, we do have our legal team involved, and we're not just going to hop over and say, hey, okay, we'll accept the tariff cost and the increased cost. We're engaged in those conversations, and we'll do what we can to mitigate those impacts.
But it sounds like now, from Jenna's comment, if I'm correct, that Mexico, where our meters are getting built, we're not paying any tariff on them. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. I think it's still kind of wait and see for sure.
Okay. And I guess thinking about the bond market, I know rating agencies take a while to downrate. And I can imagine with all this uncertainty that for-profit corporations may get, ratings may decrease. It would seem like ours, like public utilities, which have the ability to raise revenue, would probably hold up well as far as what people are looking for when they go to buy a bond.
The ratings. We need to have you out talking to the agencies. That's it.
Yes.
Yeah, and as you look at our customer profile, right? I mean, much higher dependency on residential is preferable in this type of market versus others that have a higher proportion of commercial industrial.
So Jenna, do we have any thoughts about whether the Mexico situation will stay the same or change or?
Right now, I would say that the negotiations with Mexico are fairly stable. That being said, I think that there's going to be broader supply chain impacts to some of the inputs that might go into the meters, for example, that are coming out of Mexico. So we might see shifts in pricing just because of broader trends in the supply chains.
I can pick on that very point that I have thought of. With regard to timing, costs, everything, timing then filters back into our programs, particularly on the capital side of the house, does it not?
Yep.
Okay, which means you push it out further and have to push it out further into the future.
Yeah, we manage those as close as we can to make sure that we have we can land the budget and the spend where it needs to be, but continue to do the projects. In a time.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Just slow them down.
Yeah, I mean, no project or no group of projects that are in your budget, are always on time. We're, accelerating some, pulling some back. So we just manage that as real time as we can, look at the trend lines, look at the spend rate, and try to put that on a trajectory to be the land where we need to land. And some of that is also based on revenues, right? If revenues are up and or we're in a good place from a revenue, then we can accelerate some of the spend or shift projects around based on supply chain dependencies.
Yeah, we don't have the supplies and materials, so it's kind of pretty hard.
Yeah, but we're in a good place. As Jeff talked about,
we learned a little bit of our lesson
through COVID, so we're in a good place from a inventory perspective and gives us a little bit more grace on lead times.
In the smart planning.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know this is a little off topic, and I was going to bring it up in Ryan, but it seems like the perfect time to talk about LIHEAP. And do we have thoughts about where LIHEAP is going? This is hugely important to
anyone. 2025 funding, but what I read was after that.
Jenna, can you touch on LIHEAP?
Yes, happy to give a brief update on LIHEAP. So for those that aren't aware, there was cuts at the at HHS to the folks that administer the LIHEAP program. Most of the funds for this fiscal year have been distributed. I believe there's about $390 million still outstanding that will be a challenge to disperse. And it's a bit unclear right now, and I know our delegation is working and other delegations across the country are working to understand if that core function will be moved to a different office within HHS. So that's something we're happy to keep you updated on as that develops. And we know there are several committees in Congress that, as they look at this upcoming fiscal year, will be wanting to address the administration of LIHEAP.
Thank you. Great.
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jenna. Thank you, Jeff. Great job. All right. To the next one is our tree relief for energy efficiency power program update. And Sherry Melbourne. Good morning, Sherry.
Commissioners. I'm afraid to touch this, but can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Good morning. So I'm here for an update on our tree power program. And the word TREE has the acronym Tree Relief for Energy Efficiency. And I'm Sherry Miller. I'm with Energy Services as a program manager. And with me today is Jeremiah Gardner. He's an arborist with vegetation management, and he'll talk a little bit more soon. So we first were here in December 2023, December 5th, to introduce the program. And at that time, we had just received the grant that started the program. And so we essentially had a program name, a logo, and that's as far as we were in the program development. And today's presentation is informational only. It's just an update that we promised to come back and give once we had some projects underway. A little bit about the program history. So Energy Services was awarded a $75,000 APPAD grant in April 2023. And I think we all know that APPA is American Public Power Association, but DEED is the Demonstration of Energy and Efficiency Developments Program. It's a program within APPA, and DEED looks for out of the box, innovative, unusual programs that they don't perceive have been done before, and they like to get behind those ideas and fund them. And so we got our grant to develop this urban forestry program. And the name of it is Community Tree Planting to Mitigate Air Conditioning Loads and Engage Customers. And what's very unique about DEED, besides how innovative they are in their thinking, is that they have a library of all the grants that they've provided or given over the years. And they ask that all the ideas are transferable to other utilities. So as we develop this program, we're also developing all the tools that any utility that can access the library can use to build their own urban forestry program. So not only is this benefit happening for us here, but we're spreading the seeds, so to speak, across the country for other tree programs like it to be built by other utilities. And essentially the purpose is to develop an urban forestry program that mitigates the heat island effect in Snohomish County. And this will reduce our air conditioning loads. And this happens by funding tree canopy projects in strategic locations. So trees are beautiful. They have a lot of benefits. But for us, they're partners in helping us cool these buildings and this pavement so that our loads will decrease over time and our customers' costs. There's two program components to the design of this program. There's the tree project funding and the customer donation fund. And the tree project funding is a competitive project funding program, and it supports targeted community and customer green projects primarily public agencies and nonprofits are eligible to apply. And funding can prioritize income quality communities, grid constrained areas, equity, and of course, urban heat island effect. And this was launched exactly a year ago, April 2024. And then the Customer Donation Fund is a self-funding component to the program, which is unusual for programs. And so this is where customers can voluntarily donate to these projects if they choose or are interested. This was just launched November 2024. And customers can go online to the website. They can donate $5 all the way up to any amount that they select. They can donate one time or it can be ongoing, and then their donations will be on their monthly bills. And so, as I mentioned, we just launched it November 2024. So it's very new and fresh. We have had donations and we're looking at promoting and building this up after the energy block party when we have more time.
So have we had just single donations or are people signed up to do a monthly donation?
Both.
Okay.
Yes. So last year we had 4 applications come in for funding for these projects. They were all from cities. We had the city of Arlington, which they titled it their Centennial Trail Tree Planting. The city of Everett, the Walter E. Hall Parking Lot Median Tree Replacements. And this is right near our solar array. And then the city of Mukilteo with Japanese Gulch and the city of Marysville, Third Street Tree Planting. And this is rain gardens in the middle of intersections in this area of Marysville. So status in the awards, we awarded all 4. And the city of Arlington Centennial Trail was awarded $7,250. And they've actually completed their project. We're delighted that we have a project in the ground. It's impressive because we announced at the end of August, and by October, 2 months later, they had completed their project. So we have a picture for showing a couple pictures of that. And then the city of Everett, Walter E. Hall Park, $8,955. They're going through their site preparation at the moment, and they will continue this until the fall when they expect to do their planting. The city of Mukilteo is Japanese Gulch, and they received $9,170, and their planting is targeted to be completed by the end of this month. And they are planting in a couple areas in the gulch. The main area is by the community gardens, if you know where that is. And when you walk in, there'll be a grove of 20 giant sequoias going in. So it'll be a nice way to enter the gulch. And they will make really good work of cooling for us. The city of Marysville actually withdrew their application from consideration. They needed to develop their irrigation systems in their rain gardens before they could plant trees. And I understand they're planning to resubmit. This is our evaluation team for the projects. And if you'll note, there's 4 different departments across the PUD represented in this team. And I'm on the team. And then Susie Oversby, another program manager in energy services, is on the team. It was important to have Susie on the team. She was the one that brought the idea forward for an urban forestry program. And it was based on House Bill 1114. And so she's had a very vested interest in this program the whole way through, and she needed to be a part of it. And then Jeremiah Gardner, our arborist in the vegetation department. One learns many things about other departments when you start working with them here at the PUD. And I was interested to learn in our vegetation department, we have 12 arborists. And that's so impressive for a utility our size, and we're watched by other utilities. It's like there's a lot of interest in our arborists. So I wanted to reach out to the department to ask for somebody with the expertise to make sure that these projects really had the best chance of survival, and Jeremiah was able to join us. Bill Quinlan is our landscape architect, and he's with facilities maintenance, and he also has a very in-depth knowledge of everything trees and landscape. And then Marisa Hewlett is a program manager in customer services. She has a lot of knowledge in budgets and contracts, and I knew she would be a good person for evaluation. And then Forterra Northwest is our vendor that we brought on to help support us to develop this program. They're a national forestry development vendor, and we've been working with their Northwest folks. So to recap our pilot year, last year was our first year, so it was our pilot. And then we had our applications, which we opened the program for applications on Washington State Arbor Day. That seemed very perfect. And that was April 10th of last year through the end of June. And then the evaluation team reviewed applications in July and August. They individually reviewed in July, and then we came together as a group and discussed our decisions in August. And then awards were announced in late August. And so we had four projects that we received and four that were awarded.
Sherry, do all these four projects, they all reduce air conditioning load?
The whole idea is if you think about being outside on a hot summer day and you're in the sun and it's so warm and you have to go stand under a tree because the tree cools, it's that same concept using the trees to cool buildings and cool pavement so that all that requires less air conditioning to cool the building. The trees are doing some of that work for us. It's a long-term goal.
I got it.
It will help.
Okay.
So this is the Centennial Trail tree planting and some pictures of it. I'll have Jeremiah talk in a moment, but I do want to mention that Arlington has a lot of artwork on their trail, which is very fun. And this project took place right by the police station in a section of trail between two streets. And ironically, you'll see it in the left picture, there's a metal tree, and that's part of their artwork. So here, their first project and our first project already had art honoring a tree in it, and then they just brought in the trees. So I'll let Jeremiah talk about his process with Arlington. There was a really good partnership between the city and us in basically getting to a win-win solution for this project. So
hello, Jeremiah, Vegetation Management. Meet you. So like Sherry said, they were really quick in their project implementation and their application came in super quick. Their planting plans came in and everything looked great. So she handed off to me and I was like, all right, so I'm going to sit down on a laptop, pull up the PUD's utility and see how it fits in. And then you can see from the picture that it was an immediate, holy, I don't know, there's three-phase power lines on either side of this pathway. I need to drive out there right now. So I grabbed their plans, drove out there, found the site, kind of looked it over, and was, the species weren't quite right. They picked the species correct, but the locations were wrong. You know, some of the trees were over, the tall tree to the left was over to the right. That's going to get in the power lines. We can't get a truck in there without mauling down this, you know, beautiful pathway around this tree, setting outriggers out, you know, and then hammering on a tree that's not going to provide any shade anymore. So more canopy, less trimming. That's what we're after at the BUD. Savings, everybody wins. So they were really good to work with. Like I suggested, you know, moving these things around. They were totally on board with it. And resubmitted another plan with the right tree, right place. It's just really good example of working with partners, you know, streamlining, everything fits, no hassles in the future. So we don't have to be driving, you know, pulling bollards, driving trucks down, trying to trim a tree. On the left is quite a big parking lot. And so there's several trees in that belly there to the right, you can kind of see. And so those should reach full canopy over the pathway, mature growth height, and all fit in, and we shouldn't have to touch them, you know, unless we move power lines and who knows where. So hopefully we don't have to move those to the left. But, you know, accessibility is always a concern in our field, whether you're replacing poles, which there is access to replace the poles, but when you have a tree in the middle of a span between poles, there's a building there. We can't reach over that building and trim that tree. We can't, you know, we don't want to be wrecking the landscape to get to it. So anyways, it's just kind of my component of adding job site visits. So we'll have a pre-site visit and then we'll have post-site visit to make sure they got things in the right place. They weren't planted too deep, planted correctly with the staking, you know, and then obviously maintenance after that. We'll be monitoring about every year for 3 years to make sure the viability of the trees. Otherwise, they got to replant them. You know, it's a big investment. So we want it to go well. And I guess that'll take us to the next slide and then Sherry can wrap it up.
Thank you very much. We can see why it's important to have an arborist on the team.
Absolutely. I was thinking
that. You know, it's important to have an arborist in the organization because when a customer is unhappy about a tree we need to take down, it's so nice to have an expert.
And I've heard that from customers.
Yeah.
Have an arborist come out.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And we're losing so many trees with development and buildings. And so the last thing we want is to have a customer put a tree in, like Jeremiah illustrated, in a place that then it has to come back out. So it was just a great partnership between the two, both sides very happy, successful project. And that's our first of hopefully decades of projects. Sorry, I have to go all the way through again. Okay, so that was our pilot year last year. And this year we're an official program, full-time program, starting 2025. And so our schedule for this year is that applications will open for projects coming in 2 days. And so it'll start April 10th and go through June 10th of this year. We're open to all types of projects. We this year have a special interest in libraries because libraries are cooling centers. And so it just makes a lot of sense to really start talking of libraries and encouraging projects for trees around libraries. And then also schools. Schools have so many buildings. They have so many parking lots, a lot of pavement. And of course, the budget and funding can very much help them. And our evaluation process will be June through August. We again will announce awards by August 28th. And then we will see the completion of the City of Everett from last year in fall and the City of Mukilteo, hopefully by the end of this month.
I have a question.
Sure.
The applications, you are going to reach out also nonprofits?
Oh, yes. Yeah, who's eligible for the program is government, quasi-government, or nonprofits. And we have a massive contact list for the program. And I reached out to key accounts also for additional emails and contacts to libraries and schools. And we sent out over 400 emails last week as a reminder of this application process opening.
And with the libraries, maybe you might contact the cities because some libraries, the property is owned by the cities, like a perfect example, Lingwood. So, So I don't know what policies they have in place that you have to go through with the process. So,
And some are county owned. So counties, the cities, you know, all government.
Snow Isle.
Yes,
it's not a lot of them. Well, this is an amazing program, and I think that I can see the opportunity how through maybe this through the schools, libraries, or nonprofits, vulnerable communities like perhaps the Latinos. I always reach out to many people, and they ask me why the Latinos we don't care about the planet or the environment, and it's like no, that's a assumption.
Yeah.
But we need to be involved and we need sometimes baby steps because the countries that we're coming from, we don't have that part of education about their cultures or there are so areas, rural areas, they are so poor. Mm-hmm. So it's a luxury if we have, if you have a garbage can. So that's the reality. And coming to this country, yes, the impact, mostly vulnerable communities, Black African Americans and Latinos, and always in the stories about environment is how they impact us. So again, it's an amazing opportunity how for baby steps, grassroots, planting trees and being involved in this program. But it's amazing. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, it's an exciting program. I'm incredibly passionate about it. And trees are beautiful, but they have so many functions, not just the cooling, but reducing allergies, shading our neighborhoods. You know, there's a huge list on all the benefits of trees. And we welcome all applications. We really do. So any other questions?
There's a person behind me.
So on this program, on the main page, you'll see some resources there. You'll be able to pull up what's called a heat map. Have you played with that yet? It has several layers in it.
No, but I'm familiar a little bit with that.
Okay.
Being serving in a city council, and we look at different heat maps in our city.
Okay.
And we have a program to the public utilities as well with the developments. The developers, they want to start to building something, and they have to go through and buy trees or program something like that in the city. So it's fascinating, the heat map.
Yeah, this one that we attached has multiple layers that you can turn on and off. It's, you know, kind of small. You got to figure out where the toggle buttons are, but you can turn off the heat and turn on the income metrics. And part of our evaluation team, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for equitable. Is it hot red on the map? Is it, you know, equitable? All those kind of things come into the evaluation process. So you can see those layers when you turn it on and off. What's it got? Impervious surfaces.
And tree canopy. Heat,
tree canopy, equitability, all that. Yeah, if you turn them on and off, it's kind of fun to work. So I just wanted to add that real quick.
What
so, you know, it's kind of hidden in there unless you start messing around with it.
I wonder if we get a link to that. Someone was sending
you this. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One last question. We're still working off the original deed grant money, right?
Yes, that's a great question. We are. We received the money. It's paying for our vendor plus. And the vendor's contracted through the end of June this year, and our contract officially ends with deed, with all the deliverables and the abstract completed at the end of September.
Of this year?
Of this year. Yeah.
So maybe jumping ahead and saying something I shouldn't, but I'm assuming that we might be considering absorbing some of that and continuing. Mm-hmm. See,
it's a very low cost program, which has a lot of benefits, and so that's great. And Jeremiah brought up a good point about the website. So you're welcome to look to the website. The link would just be to our webpage, snowpud.com/treepower. And then you'll see our homepage, you'll see the customer donation portal, and then the project application portal. And then on the right are some resources where the heat map is and a one pager about the program. And also, if you're looking at the trees in your own yard, we have lists that Jeremiah put together of recommended small, medium, and large trees that do well in our county, and also a section on trees he doesn't recommend and why, what the issues are. So before you go to the nursery, you might want to check that list.
I have a follow comment for Commissioner Olson. So this grant that you received, you mentioned that we need to spend the money in September.
We will have spent the money in September. But the grant closes. We're under a contract for the grant, and it all closes at the end of September.
Okay, so if you receive applications and accept the deadline is June 10, mm-hmm. 2025, so means significant, the people, they are, they they are awarded, they're going to receive the money and they have to spend that between June to September?
No, basically the grant helped us launch the program. And then it gave us the foothold to really have the resources to build it, develop it, and launch it. And then we carry it forward, but D just steps away.
Okay.
And so they just did their part, gave us the influx of grant funding, and then we did the work, and we continue for decades, but then their process is complete.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, great job, Sherry.
All right, I'm wondering if we should take a short break.
Sounds like a great idea.
It's 10:25. Let's resume at 10:35. All right, it is 10:35.
Awesome. So next up is Adam Cornelius presenting on our renewable energy credit procurement overview and proposed purchase. Morning, Adam.
Morning, Adam.
Morning, commissioners. So I'm here today to give you an overview of how we procure renewable energy credits, and then talk about a proposed purchase that we'll hopefully be bringing back for you later on this year. So we'll start with some background of the Energy Independence Act, or EIA. Which is has a requirement that we procure, that we use a certain portion of our energy from renewable energy. We'll talk about our own approach to compliance and then give you some of the details of this proposed REC renewable energy credit purchase. So the Energy Independence Act, or EIA, has a number of components, but one of those is a renewable portfolio standard. These are programs that exist in different states around the country, but this is Washington's. And it is a requirement that utilities use a combination of eligible renewable resources for their load or acquire renewable energy credits equal to an amount of 15% that utilities load. A REC, or renewable energy credit, is a tradable instrument that represents the renewable and environmental attributes of 1 megawatt hour of energy from a renewable resource. You may think, well, we're 95 plus percent clean, and that's true due to all the hydro we use from our own resources and from Bonneville's, but the EIA rules exclude most hydro generation from qualifying. So it's 15% of other sources of renewables typically. RECs can be sold bundled with the underlying energy. Our wind contracts, how we purchase them. We buy both the energy and the RECs together, or unbundled. So we can go out on a market for RECs that we can go buy or sell as needed that are separate from the energy. You can use RECs for, there's some flexibility in the program. You can use RECs for compliance in the year they're generated or within 1 year before or after. And important for later is that RECs from distributed generation, that's resources that are smaller than 5 megawatts, are eligible for a 2x multiplier. So if we buy one REC, that counts as 2 RECs for our own compliance needs. We have always been, and we strive to be compliant with the program for all sorts of reasons, but one of those is that the penalty for non-compliance is $75 a megawatt hour, which is very steep. And there's currently no end date to these EIA requirements. So we'll keep planning for these targets until we hear otherwise.
But do our small hydro projects, do we get that?
Our small hydro projects, for the most part, do not count. One, if we want to get into the weeds a little bit, there is a provision that incremental hydro, so improvements to hydro projects qualify. And so I believe it's Woods Creek, where we get a few recs for some incremental improvements we made to that project. And otherwise, no, they do not qualify under Washington's program.
But nothing we have qualifies for double.
Let's see. I think that our Hampton recs may qualify for double.
Okay.
And I can double check on that.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the non-compliance penalty?
Sure.
It's $75.
Yeah, so let's say we had a target where, based on our load, our target was 15% of our load, maybe 1 million megawatt hours. But we need to procure 1 million RECs. If we only procured 900,000 RECs, we would be on the hook for $75 times 100,000.
Okay, thank you.
And that's, you know, much higher than the cost of a buying REC. So it's, we're certainly very incentivized to comply. Okay, so our compliance approach, so we plan for this, right? This is a long-term, you know, this is, as I mentioned, no end in sight. So we plan over the long-term. So we, you know, the starting point for our compliance approach is that we include these requirements in our integrated resource planning to inform the least cost and least risk resource strategy. This is part of that. In 2023, our last completed IRP, they identified that we would use a mix, the best strategy was to use a mix of bundled renewables, so renewables with the RECs, and unbundled REC purchases to meet the gap in our compliance. Now, as we've transitioning to the load following product, bringing renewables to load is more challenging. And so this part of this transition is that it places more emphasis on unbundled REC purchases in the near term. Any questions on the EIA as a whole, RECs, how we're generally planning for compliance?
Again, my question is on the near term. So we're gonna have another presentation. You know, we're in a transition period.
Yeah.
Is that what's meant by near term here? I mean, if we went out and built a big solar project, it might cause complications with our new boggle in the short term.
That's right. So I think in that once we get to the new contract in October 2028, we'll likely have some more. And if we cross into that tier two threshold, there are more opportunities to use, you know, to bring non-federal energy to load.
Bundle.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So it's part of that consideration. So, you know, currently we've been over time, you know, using a mix of those bundled renewables, unbundled RECs, and our unbundled REC purchases are typically under some existing authority that's been was granted by the commission in 2018, Resolution 5844, where the general manager or his designee is authorized to purchase unbundled RECs to meet our statutory and regulatory requirements. And that purchase does have some, that authorization has some limitations. It's limited to the volume needed to meet the current and the next compliance year. It's limited to quantities and strategies specified in the IRP or other analysis as needed. And we review counterparties for creditworthiness. So as I said, since that time, we've made a number of REC purchases consistent with authority. But when we have a proposed purchase that's outside of those bounds, particularly that first one, the timing, we bring it before the board for, you know, an individual resolution and offerings. So we have a proposed REC purchase to share with you today. Lime Wind is a small 3-megawatt wind project located in Northeast Oregon. Family-owned project, and actually the owner is on the call here. So if you have any questions about the project, he's available to answer them. And they are offering unbundled RECs for the full output of that project. This would be for a 6-year term from 2026 through 2031. Their historic average annual production is about 5,700 megawatt hours. And they've shared that data with us. It's really consistent year over year. And there's some fluctuation from year to year, but it's you know, a reasonable expectation. And you know, as a reminder, right, anything that's smaller than 5 megawatts qualifies as distributed generation and therefore receives that 2x multiplier for EIA compliance. So the price is $11.50 per generated REC. That works out when we think about our own compliance needs as $5.75 per REC because of that 2x multiplier. So our expected annual cost will be $65,500 per year.
We're purchasing all the RECs.
We're purchasing all the RECs as they're generated. So it could vary if it's the wind output obviously generates from day to day, hour to hour, month to month, and year to year. So as it's generated, we would purchase all of them. And so some considerations about this proposed purchase. We think that this contract structure has, you know, relatively low risk to the PUD. The generator would provide assurance that the RECs are eligible for EIA and the 2x multiplier. And my understanding is that they, when they, under a previous sale to a different off-taker of those RECs, they met that need. Their unit contingent, as I mentioned, so it's based on the RECs that are actually generated. We pay after the receipt of the RECs. And you know, the price is good value because of that 2x multiplier. And then just going back to those limitations under the resolution, it's really that multi-year nature of the agreement, the 26 to 31, that requires us to receive board authorization before making the purchase. Recall that the resolution allowed us to purchase RECs for the current year and the next year's compliance. Otherwise, it's consistent. This quantity certainly fits within the volume identified by the IRP and our own analysis of what our expected load is. And the transaction is subject to a final determination by the PUD of the creditworthiness of the counterparty. That's still under review.
I understand,
sure,
in this situation how the creditworthiness matters to us.
Good question. It is, so I think there is, this is generally a relatively low risk proposition to the PUD from the reasons shared in the the kind of first section there. We'll be paying after the fact.
Right.
But I think there's, maybe in the event that there's an issue with EIA compliance or the multiplier eligibility or some other issue, we like to have that in place. It's kind of part of our standard practice.
Our due diligence.
Our due diligence.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll wait till a presentation is done. I do have a
couple. So our recommendation today, we have two. The first one is kind of the primary one that we recommend that the commission authorize the general manager execute the 6-year agreement for the purchase of approximately 5,700 RECs per year. And once we have that financial review and the an agreement in principle with the counterparty, we would bring that forward back to you. We anticipate in the June to July timeframe. The second recommendation is that we are interested in exploring a potential update to that REC purchase authorization that could allow more flexibility in planning for our regulatory compliance needs. Likely that time frame of just this year and next year. Our prior authority was granted an environment when we had lower targets and we were generally new to purchasing unbundled RECs because we were using our renewable purchases and bundled energy basically to meet almost all of our compliance. So in preparation for that 15%, to hit that new 15% target, we wanted to be able to go out and make REC purchases. The goal, as I understand it, was before I was at the PUD, but was to provide staff with the flexibility to purchase RECs needed for compliance while providing the commission the opportunity to guide strategy through the IRP, but putting some reasonable sidebars on. As the need is increasing, there could be benefits in going out for more multi-year purchases. We've gotten a lot of experience. We've made a number of purchases under this authority. We have a pretty good feel for the market. But if we were to do this analysis on whether something like this would be beneficial, we would certainly provide considerations of all those elements and the reasons why we had those sidebars on the existing resolution. We don't have a specific recommendation at this point. We would probably come back with a new presentation and then a resolution to follow.
Would this be a recommendation just on unbundled RECs?
I think that's the way we're thinking about it. This is kind of early. This is as we've kind of been planning for our needs over the next several years. This has come up as something that could be beneficial. And that's all I have. So if we, any questions?
Well, your last comments was one of the areas that, and even when you bring it back, it could remind me why the rationale behind why this was set up initially.
Absolutely.
But what you bring back from my perspective should continue to recognize or its responsibility in terms of oversight.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I'm opposed to this. And also, is this project generating now? Is it going to be constructed?
No, it is online and maybe if Lauren wanted to, Lauren Joseph is the owner that's online, he could maybe answer how long it's been online and things like that.
You've answered my question.
Okay, got it.
It's not something that's in progress. It's generating.
Yes, that's correct.
And let me make sure, point of clarification, staff wants to bring back a potential recommendation on altering the way we procure these RECs. And that is in large part, and Adam, you correct me if I'm wrong, because we are switching to load following and we aren't in the market buying power and being able to buy bundled RECs in order to satisfy this. So is that the big part of the change and why we are want to reconsider or at least talk about should there be a change to the practice?
I would say it's a portion as our wind contracts are rolling off.
Yes.
Anyways, we do have an increasing need over kind of the second half of this decade. There could have been impetus either way, but the switch shift to load following puts kind of more pressure on those unbundled purchases.
Got it.
So it's a comment.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, we seem like going forward, unbundled RECs or just buying these or anything else, it's just an expense we're going to have with our new model card.
Yeah,
but bundle RECs to me that's a different thing. We're going to construct a project, or someone's constructing a project,
and there's other risk involved.
Yeah.
And it could be, right, it could be part of a new project, it could be a power purchase agreement for, they can incur in different ways in those bundle cracks, but absolutely, yeah.
So, Adam, you said that the owner of the project is on.
Yes, yeah.
Was he wanting to speak to us today?
I think he wanted to make himself available if you had any questions for him about the project.
Okay. Well, his hand's up, so let's...
Oh, okay.
Lauren Joseph?
Yeah, that's him. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and admit him into the...
Oh, this is Lauren. Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, in 2011, we came online, and we've been generating now for almost 15 years, and things are going really well. This is a family-owned wind farm, so my father brought this to fruition, and my brother and I work it now together and continue his work. So not much like it in really anywhere in the U.S. This is on BLM land. We have a lease agreement from them, and brought six Nordtank 500 wind turbines over from Germany, had them rebuilt, and they are going gangbusters as we speak.
Thank you. Any questions for Lauren, Commissioner?
I have none. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your project. Sounds like a great project.
Well, of course. Thank you guys for considering the purchase of the RECs.
Any other questions?
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
All right, last presentation for today is our update on our 2025 Integrated Resource Plan, Phase 2, and Landon Snyder. Morning, Landon.
Morning. Morning, Commissioners. I'm Landon Snyder. I'm a senior utility analyst here at the UD in the Power Supply Department. Just me up here today, but I've got a few people with me behind me if you guys have any questions that they can add context or other help on. So let's go and get to the agenda. Push this button. There we go. All right, so today we're gonna go through the integrated resource plan refresher, which is to say, what is an IRP and kind of what are the phases. Then we're really gonna dive into phase two, which is really that load forecast and our resource forecast. And then we're gonna do some next steps in Q&A. I do wanna highlight one piece here. This briefing is informational, so we're not actually asking any action from the commission today. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get this IRP or integrated resource party started. So refresher, right? So what is an integrated resource plan or IRP, and how are we doing this? So typically, if you direct your eyes down to the bottom of the page there, there's five green boxes there. And how we do this is we divide it into phases. So phase one, we briefed you back in January on. Right now we're talking phase two, and that's really looking at, again, load and resource forecasts. Phase three looks at resource options out there in the world that we can potentially procure. Phase four takes all those inputs, shoves them into an optimization engine, big mathematical model, and then that spits out an output for us to develop phase five, which is a resource strategy and subsequent action plan to accomplish that, that modeling output, and also produce the IRP document itself. So that's kind of the general IRP concept. The thing to note is that the IRP is a long-term resource strategy, so it really covers a 20-year period from 2026, the first year one, all the way through 2045, which is a 20-year time span. Now, I should note that the PUD has a statutory obligation to produce these IRPs. So the way the statute is written, we have to produce an IRP every 4 years, and then 2 years thereafter, we have to do an update. So we'll be back to the commission in 2 years' time talking about how we're going to update this IRP and how the world has changed around us since then. So that's the kind of job security I need in my life. That's just a constant reproduction of
IRP. Always IRP.
That's right. There's always something to do. That's good. So talking about a review of phase one. So phase one, that's our scoping phase. That's where we gathered a bunch of experts in the PUD. We talked to the public, our customers, And we got their thoughts and we created some scenarios and some sensitivities. So what's a scenario? A scenario is basically an entire world that's constructed of a lot of different variables out there, market environments, load forecast, things like that. And each scenario is very different from every other scenario. So we start with our base case. That's kind of like the quote unquote expected. You got your low, your high, different technology scenarios, things like that. And then we have sensitivities. And a sensitivity is just where you take, in this case, the base case, and we adjust just one single variable. So in this IRP, where we're thinking BPA cost changes. Like what if Bonneville costs a lot more or a lot less, for example? Thin renewable energy credit market. So what if there's not a lot of RECs out there? Or a change in policy, right? Like what if CETA changes or the Clean Energy Transformation Act? So that's just the different things that we're kind of thinking about. This one, and again, this was already briefed back in January, so this is just a quick review for y'all. And then phase two is really what I want to spend most of the time today talking about, which is this is where our long-term load forecast meets our resources. Right? So we do load forecasting and resource forecasting for every single hour of the study period, which is, if you do the math, 8,760 hours in the study or a year times 20 years, that's a lot of different hours, right? We also do different weather simulations or weather traces. So we have 65 different versions of every single study because weather changes and hydrology changes and the world, and we never are certain like what it's going to be. So we need to simulate 65 different versions at least to get an idea of what the world could be like out there. And that's kind of the probabilistic nature of IRP forecasting. Each simulation has climate change assumptions built into it. So climate change changes temperature and hydrology over time. So we're really capturing that. Important. Each simulation has population growth, building stocks growth. So by sector. So for example, we have primarily residential, commercial, industrial, right? And then this is kind of a newish one in the last handful of years or so is talking about electrification, right? Not just of new buildings, but of existing buildings, so retrofits, and also big one, EVs, right? So EVs are coming around, they're coming around big, and that adds load to the grid. That's something we need to encompass and think about. But also we have stuff that drives load down. So we look at baseline, demand side resource forecasts. So that's your energy efficiency and your rooftop solar. And we kind of have like a natural adoption curve that we kind of assume built into the long-term forecast, which kind of drives load down. So people are putting, solar on the roof, they're buying energy efficient appliances and things like that. So we need to make sure that we incorporate that as well. But also that's the load side.
So how about we're going to talk about time of use rates here at some point in the near future. Those kind of things, would that fall into that?
So we're going to talk about probably that in phase three.
Okay.
As kind of like a resource option. So kind of the short version would be we have a DRPA or demand response potential assessment, and time of use rates is going to be part of that resource option of, is it cost effective?
Right.
Our last IRP did find that it was, just for the record, but every single IRP cycle we redo a lot of the math. So all to say, stay tuned, phase three. And then kind of back on to this slide here, we have our resource forecast. So that's, we have resources now. We have contracts with Bonneville, we have our own hydro, and we need to forecast those resources over that 20-year period as well. So let's talk a little,
I'm sorry. I want to follow the comment that Commissioner. So even though the phase three is when we're going to talk about costs, but right now what happened at the federal level, and they're not going to impact your phase two.
I'm sorry, can you be a little more?
So everything that happens and changing the prices like Bonneville and everything, so that it doesn't impact the phase two?
Yeah, so this is just kind of the load forecasting side of it and resource forecasting side of it. The kind of cost side of things, that's definitely more of a phase three where we evaluate both energy attributes. So like, what does this thing actually do in terms of generation or providing us power, and then the cost of that power as well.
And so, maybe give you time also when you present to us the phase three, maybe everything is settled down at the time. So
Who knows? But also, kind of importantly, I'm going to go back to one piece here. There's that EPA cost changes, right? So that's one example where, you know, what if things are a little bit more expensive because of whatever reason, right?
Yeah.
So that's something we are actually going to put in.
But I like that you present different scenarios. I really appreciate that. I mean, if the plan A doesn't work, I mean, that's a lot of letters in the alphabet. So you can go through and present different scenarios. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Exactly. And in phase five, which will be, you know, later on this year, that's where we develop our full resource strategy, which could incorporate any one of these futures into it. Our goal is to develop a very flexible and nimble strategy where if any one of these things comes true, we're ready for it, right? We're not just reacting to the world around us, but we're already prepared. It's kind of like the end goal.
Let me make sure to clarify, are you potentially thinking that the economic factors of the next, you know, week, month, year, and if we would have entered into a recession or other economic conditions where manufacturing would slow down, would that have an impact on load?
Yes.
I think that's
yes.
The question.
Oh, yeah.
Would we factor that into
Thank
the
you.
Load forecast?
Oh, right. Okay. So that is going to be actually, you know what? Let's go to the next slide. We'll probably answer that question
Thank
via
you.
This next slide. Yeah.
So
part of our scenario development is doing a load forecast for each scenario. So this slide shows our net load forecast. So net being after energy efficiency forecasts driving load down, like where we're going to be sitting based on these three main kind of load forecast scenarios. So kind of an answer to your question, Commissioner, looking at kind of like a scenario where maybe load growth is a bit less because of a recession, that's probably going to look a lot like that orange line. So any strategy that we build is going to encompass the idea that that could be a potential future, right? And then conversely, right, like what if there's a high growth scenario where there's just a lot of development, that's going to look a lot like that kind of grayish line.
Okay.
That do a little better?
Yes, thank you.
You're very welcome. Okay, so looking at this graph on the right there, kind of showing you how to read it. So the x-axis is your time. The y-axis is going to be your kind of average annual load. Right. So 2025, that's kind of ish where we're sitting now. Right. And then you can see over time, our load is growing. And that actually is true. Our load is growing and we forecast it to continue to grow. What I really want to highlight here is the green line. That's our kind of base case. And then the yellow line. The yellow line is kind of a callback to our previous IRP. It's from 2023. And you kind of see the green and yellow are somewhat, for the most part, you know, there's a little bit of difference, but they really diverge around that 2032-2033 period. And that is because our load forecast has gone down a little bit in the long term. And you might reasonably ask, but Landon, why would our load forecast be reduced relative to the last round of IRPs? And the answer is because we've kind of changed some thoughts around mostly EVs. The idea is that there's going to be a lot of hybrid work schedules incorporated into the long-term forecast now, so therefore less EV driving miles. And then also there's some assumptions of mass transit now built into it, which also drives down EV load consumption. So a little bit of a load reduction in terms of like what we're previously thinking, but still, you know, that's mostly going to be in the long term in that 2030 and beyond period.
I guess the other thing is that we're not really seeing load growth in the last 2 years, right? We're seeing our peaks are getting bigger, but we're not a stable. Are we seeing annual overall?
I think there has been a little bit of load growth, but definitely there has been peaks. You are absolutely right. Our peaks have definitely got peak year, and we're going to show that on the next slide. So stay tuned. but kind of some summary stats on the left there, right? So, you know, in the low base and high case, right, you see kind of average annual load growth in the 1.5 to 2.1% range. And then kind of the, you know, over the full study period, the full 20-ish year period, right, there's this kind of like, hey, we're going from, you know, sub 800 to, you know, 1,000, you know, like plus range, right? So we are anticipating load growth no matter what we do here. So we need to be ready for that. So let's talk about peak load growth, because this is average annual load growth. Peaks we have to plan for too. So peak load growth. This is the same kind of general graph, except now we're looking at peaks. So really what's changed here is the magnitude. So before we started at around 800 and we got up above 1,000 range, now we're starting at that 1600 range, which is
very realistic. I mean, we recently experienced a 1600 peak. So this has shown that load and how those peaks grow. So before, we were looking at like 1.5 to 2.1% average annual load growth. Our peak load growth is going faster than our averages. So we're experiencing and anticipate to continue to experience peak load growth that exceeds our annual load, our average growth. So all to say that we're getting peakier.
Is this peak the absolute peak we expect in the year, like a single day? Or is this some kind of, we expect 10 days at this being the average, or trying to put this into context?
Right. So the math, the way we do this, this is stochastic modeling. So we take a probabilistic distribution. This would be the 95th percentile, right? And then we take like the max hour within that. That's the way the math points out. All right. So, and again, kind of the 2023 IRP throwback, which is that yellow line. Again, it looks kind of similar to some stuff, and then it kind of, you know, goes up there. And, you know, it's all to say, again, it's because our load forecast has gone ever so slightly down, particularly in like the last 10, 15 years. All to say, so this is our resource forecast, our load forecast. Now we need to talk about resources, right? One more slide about this. So that was our load forecast, our net. This is going to be our kind of dividing that net load forecast into our different sectors. So again, from left to right, we got three graphs. We have our low case, our base case, and our high case, right? We have these now shaded sectors. So green is going to be our residential and commercial, which is kind of our bread and butter. The yellow is going to be our industrial load. That's always been kind of flat for the most part. And then our EV is that kind of one that starts off pretty small, because it is pretty small now, but it grows to be pretty big. And then the red line for each graph, that's where our load is anticipated to actually be, because we are deploying energy efficiency, because our customers putting rooftop solar on, driving that load down. So that's where our net load ends up resolving at. And one thing that's a little bit different in that middle graph you'll see is, again, that throwback to the 2023 IRP, but where we thought we would be, right? And how that's adjusted this time around.
So I'm sorry to keep asking questions. So net is net of what?
Take energy efficiency, drives that load down.
Okay. That's what I was.
It's mostly energy efficiency. I think some rooftop solar in there too. So a different way of saying is we anticipate a baseline amount of energy efficiency built into our load forecast and a baseline amount of rooftop solar in the long term.
Okay.
And that amount grows over time. All right, and then EVs, that's the big orange piece that starts off very little, but you can see it's growing a lot. So if you have any questions about that, let me know. All right, so this is our load, but let's talk resources. You know, how are we going to serve this? All right. So one thing in this IRP that's very different from last ones is we have now switched Bonneville products. Right. So this is going to be an example of kind of how our load following product works at a very high level. Okay. So Bonneville provides us tier one and tier two power. Tier one power is very, very inexpensive, relatively speaking, power from the existing system. Tier two power is what comes after that. So what do I mean when I say after that? I mean, we only get so much of that tier one power until we hit what's called a contract ceiling or contract high watermark. And then we venture into, okay, so we're capped out of that amount of that very, very relatively inexpensive power. We need now get something else to serve that incremental need. And that incremental need in this example is shown that little tiny sliver of gray is going to be Bonneville Tier 2 or some non-federal resource that we go out and procure, right? It's going to be something else that isn't Tier 1 because we're capped out of Tier 1. So if you look at that graph on the right there, you can kind of see this green line at the top there. It starts at around, you can call it 800, and then it kind of goes up to maybe 810 from year one to year two there. That's an example of one, us experiencing low growth, but two, the orange box, which is our tier one, doesn't change. It's flat. We've already mapped out, but that little tiny sliver of gray goes up, and that gray is again something that's not tier one, so tier two or some non-federal resource, and that's how we have to serve that additional load.
So the limit of tier one is an annual average?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so
peaks don't necessarily put us into tier two.
No, that's the beauty of the
might, but they don't.
No, it's all based on annual. So
okay.
I have a demonstration down the line of how load following serves peaks, which is actually pretty different from what our past experience. So and we'll kind of get into that. Absolutely. So one of the core questions that this IRP, this round, is really solving is that in this case, this little gray box is like what volume of tier two or non-federal resources, like whatever that mix is going to be, is economical for us. Right. So Bonneville will always provide us the amount of tier two we need, but we might be able to do it for some price less than that. And that's part of the myth.
Can you hit me with that one again?
So Bonneville will always be there to provide us tier two service. Well, not necessarily.
Okay, well, then let's go past that.
It can be market.
So, yeah, I heard that was, then we have the choice as to whether to go into tier two
yeah.
or go elsewhere, which is,
when
is that?
Correct. So when we actually elect, like during the tier two election process, how much tier two we want. And that's going
to
be.
Well, we have to lock ourselves in.
Yeah, that's right. And then there's, and this kind of gets into the weeds a little bit, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but there's different types of tier two. And that's really going to be, again, a phase three thing when we show you the resource options out there. So those different types will, stay tuned.
If we decide to develop our own projects or purchase energy from projects,
right,
to avoid tier two, we only have to worry about how much we're purchasing for the average for the year, and Bonneville has to deal with the peaking in tier one. Like if we went out and bought wind farms or solar solar projects,
right,
and got plenty of average megawatts,
yeah,
could we stay out of tier two?
Correct. Theoretically, yes. So the way that works is we go out and we acquire a resource at some cost, and let's say we go down that road. Theoretically, we would only want to do that if it made sense to do so, like economically.
Right, I understand.
Right.
It seems like a bad deal for Bonneville. They have to deal with the leaky.
I mean, stay tuned. Serving peaks isn't free, and that does go into the math.
Right, that's right.
But I thought you just said that we need to obligate ourselves to some level of tier two.
We need to get some sort of resource, which is that gray bar, saying that it's either tier two or a non-federal resource, because we need to start load. And then phase three goes into those resource options of presenting the cost of those resources. And then phase four is, again, optimization of what mix it makes sense to do.
Thank you.
Do we have to subscribe to tier two, or do we just get tier two if we run out of tier one and we haven't covered it ourselves? They send us the bill at the end of the year, or how does that work?
Operationally speaking, I do not actually know how that works if we elect not to have tier two.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you exactly how that shows up on our bill. I would have to run that back to you.
Yeah, that's fine. I've understood. Thank you.
All right. So core IRP question is what that gray box ends up looking like, right? That's one of the core questions. So let's get into kind of adding detail. So the left graph we've seen before, this is a reproduction of it again. That's our load by sector, right? Our residential, our industrial, and our EV forecast on a kind of annual average basis. And on the right-hand graph is the exact same graph, except, well, the exact same shape and magnitudes, except it is now divided into resources. So if the left is load, the right is the resources that are serving that load, right? So on the bottom, that's our tier one. That's kind of that flat block. We're already capped out, right? So there's no more, incremental tier one that we can tap into, right? And then the purple, that's our existing non-federal resource. So that's our, for the most part, our own hydro. Right? And then the orange box in this case is the new tier two or new non-federal resources that we have to tap into. And then there's our rooftop solar and energy efficiency baseline forecast. And this is how all that load is being served on a forecast basis.
So 29, it looks like our tier one dropped slightly. Is that?
Yeah. So that's a result of our contract high watermark kind of lowering a little bit. We have slightly lower assumptions. So currently it sits at, I think the number is 799 or 801. I apologize, can't remember exactly. We do anticipate to go down to a little bit with the provider of choice contract.
So this is looks like we will need tier two, potentially need tier two resources from the get-go.
Correct.
To start.
Okay. Or you know, again, tier two or new non-federal resources.
Yes, correct.
Yep. We hit that territory on the first year of our
contract. But not our own resources. So we have like SPADA.
I'm sorry?
Like SPADA, like our Jackson project. Where does that fit into?
That's the purple right there. So there's a purple right. Sliver, yeah. Yeah, that's our existing hydro resource, mostly hydro resources. Right. So this is again an annual look at loads and resources, but we don't do our planning on an annual basis. It makes for good slides, but we also look like a lot more granular. So we're going to add more detail here and look at very granular load service. So in this case, we have two graphs on the left and on the right, and they're both scaled to the same y-axis. And the reason I did that is to kind of show you the difference between our monthly kind of median position versus our monthly kind of max peaky position. And it really shows a stark contrast between how our average load is growing on a month-to-month basis, year-to-year, month-to-month, versus how our peaks are growing on that same kind of time scale. All right. So I've kind of reorganized the resource blocks down at the bottom a little bit. So you can see the orange is again our tier two or new non-federal resources that we'll need. The purple is still our own hydro that we have now, for the most part hydro. And then there's some rooftop solar and energy efficiency. But this really shows, especially on that right-hand graph, how our tier one service serves a peak load. Bonneville with our tier one will just serve our peak load. It just follows our load, no matter how big that peak grows. Now, it is not free. It does cost money. Every time that the peak grows, we do pay for that. And another core question that we're looking at solving in this IRP is, can we cut that peak at a more cost-effective rate than Bonneville charges us for it? And right now, we haven't done all the math yet, but right now it looks like batteries, locally sited batteries in particular, are a good way to do that. So another way to do that is through a smart rate program, Smart Response. So again, all that math needs to be done.
All right. So that would manage peaks, but it doesn't manage the new resources.
Right. So
it actually consume energy.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's kind of two different questions. One is like, do we need more energy? Well, then we need to get either more tier two or more resources, right? And then the other side is, well, can we cut our peaks for a cost effective way? Or find a cost-effective way to cut our peaks with batteries or command response, right? So it's kind of two different ways to reduce our quote-unquote kind of backstop on a bill. Right. That leads us to next steps. So phase three, it's going to be a big one. That's going to be resource options. We plan on briefing the commission in Q2 of this year. And then phase four is, again, take all those inputs, shove them into the optimization engine, get the outputs. That's going to be in Q3 of this year. And then phase five is where we take those optimized portfolios and we develop a resource strategy and an action plan to execute that resource strategy, as well as the IRP document itself. And that's going to be in Q4 of this year.
Point of clarification on page 11, slide 11.
Yes.
Did I hear you correctly that tier one, we'll manage our peaks.
Right.
All in tier one.
All.
Okay.
Yep. Unless, again, mathematically, we can find ways to cut it more cost effective.
Right. I got that part. But, all right. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Questions?
No. I did that, yes.
Questions or comments?
No
question. Great presentation. Must be exciting to. You can look at it from a whole different way.
The change from the block and slice world was definitely
No, gotta say that much. We'll be looking forward to what we come up with when we look at resources. You know, we just had an opportunity to hear about dry rock geothermal, and last year we had fusion. Last time we had fusion in our IRP, probably maybe one of the few utilities in the nation that did. So it'll be curious to see how those things come in and cost and what makes sense for us.
So dry rock is a form of EGS, right? Enhanced geothermal. I know we are looking at that in our resource options. I can't recall offhand like where it sits right now. It's definitely a resource that's on our radar.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Oh, one last point of order. I did add some supplemental slides at the end that go into a little more detail on like EV load, industrial load, things like that.
Excellent job, Landon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, that is it for the study session.
The next we have the general manager report.
I do have a couple items here to share. First, from our HR group, just to let you know, the manager monthly workshop series was launched in 2025 to support our strategic initiative 5.1B, which is to increase manager effectiveness, facilitated by HR subject matter experts. And the topics include such things as manager expectations and accountability, harnessing the power of the employee performance improvement plans, and things like that. We really believe that in order for us to continue to drive positive culture change, we need to continue to invest in our managers and leaders. Our corporate communications, couple items, our Woods Creek field trips are in full swing. Last week, we had over 120 Monroe High School students from environmental science classes attend. This was the first high school to receive one of our transportation grants. This is a great way to connect with our customers and inspire a future generation of utility workers, and is a demonstration of excellent collaboration between our education programs and our generation and natural resources team. And also, our very own Taylor Ostrander spoke at the 2025 NWPPA Administrative Professionals Conference last week in Leavenworth on the topic of the people side of change. Those are the updates. Happy to answer any questions or talk about any other topics of interest.
Questions or comments, Jen?
Topics of interest, but don't get me started.
I just got back from vacation about 1 a.m. this morning, and I'm still not in full brain mode. I ever get there.
Did your team win or lose?
You know, I didn't have, I wasn't really pulling for either one of those teams. One of those teams beat my team, so.
Oh, their team lost.
Yes, my team lost. Thank you for pulling that out.
Sorry to bring it up. Basketball.
Well, the team that won hasn't won since, what, 2008?
Yeah, it's been a little bit. Florida? Yeah. The team that lost had never won.
They never won, yeah.
Yeah.
No. Well, they were. It was like in the last 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah. It was a good game.
Yeah. All right. Next, we have item 5, commission business, 5A commission report. Any reports, commissioners?
Well, I would like to mention that tomorrow is the Arbor Day celebration. It's going to be in Everett. Yes.
You'll
enjoy the city of Everett. So, yes. So.
Are we going to have all our arborists there? Mm-hmm. We typically
I would bring an umbrella.
That's very impressive.
Thank you for doing that.
No, thank you. That's amazing. I think it's going to be nice.
I think you'll enjoy it. Commissioner
Olson,
I have one thing I wanted to discuss real briefly. So first of all, thank you both for and everybody for as we try to figure out going to all morning meetings and not having the afternoon. But one of the things I want to talk about is John and Allison and I talked, and what we were thinking, if this works for the two of you, is as long as we think our meetings are going to end by 1, keep going until 1. But if we think they're going to go longer, stop and take a 30-minute lunch break. And does that work?
Thank you very much. That does work because I've felt sometimes pressured and withheld questions.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that.
And we don't want that. So the other thing we could do, the other nuance is, if we know we're going to take a 30-minute break, we can decide that a bit in the, you know, early, and we could have a preset order set up where staff could just like do a DoorDash order or something like that. Like if we all picked like a sandwich shop or something like that. Does that have interest in you of having food available for that 30 minutes or?
Well, I really think we could bring
it.
That would be better for us.
You said sandwich.
No, I'll leave it up to you too.
Okay.
I can bring my.
But thank you because I feel like that sometimes if the meetings won't end before 1 p.m., yes, it's necessary to have that day. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Depending on what kind of food you brought in, whether you would meet our wellness challenge and get any credits.
See, you're going to regret this.
is there a rec program for healthy fruits? Can we? Yes, Allison.
Just to confirm, this will be only if we go until 1 o'clock, but we'll make that decision maybe later.
Yeah, if we anticipate going past 1,
yeah,
then you would make an early decision to take a lunch break. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Next, we have 5B, our commission events calendar. Are there any changes to the events calendar?
I have only a question regarding April 29. I have that in my calendar for regional apprenticeship pathways.
Okay.
I do. Okay, I think Morgan was just waiting for a response if you were going to attend or not. Oh. So if you want to respond to her, she'll get you.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Okay. Any other changes? Okay, next we have 5C, our February 2025 district dashboard. Any questions about the dashboard? Are you looking? I'll make a comment. So, maybe I'm not reading this right, but I'm wondering, should we be looking at a moving average, right? So we're only got 2 months of data. So the data doesn't tell us a lot because it's only 2 months in the year. I'm wondering, how does the leadership team look at this? And is a moving average like an average of 6 months? How do we know? If we've left off the history, obviously, for the previous year, how do we know what our trend is with only 2 months? It's not something that has to be answered today, but I'm just trying to understand.
So that's referencing?
Well, like OSHA recordable injuries.
It's a shortened time frame. That was... Sometimes...
You've
got the expert right here.
Hi, Laura Lemke, Senior Program Manager. If you would rather see a rolling 12-month average, that's easy to swap in, and we could still provide you a graph that allows you to see how the current year is working, similar to what we're doing on reliability, where we're giving you both numbers, the year-to-date number and the last 12 months number. We could give you that similar comparison for the other metrics. It's a very simple change. Okay. And it would be consistent with the way that we talk about it internally.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. I'll make that change for the March report.
And I can.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Anything else on the performance metrics? Okay.
Next, we'll move on to item six, our governance planning calendar. Are there any changes to the governance planning calendar? On page 141 of our packet. The only thought I have on this is I'm wondering at some point in the future if it makes sense to have a deeper conversation where we know more about the impacts on this year's budget and next year's budget of tariffs. I guess that was just a thought. I don't know, commissioners, if that's something.
So sooner than the regular budget conversation?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm thinking, first of all, I know we don't know much yet, right? But I guess when we do know something, I'm curious to understand. I'm worried about how it might impact this year's budget. And then obviously worried about the next year's budget. I guess next year's budget,
that would be,
we're going to be starting having those conversations pretty soon.
Yeah.
Well, I guess maybe we don't need it because we're going to be, that's going to start probably being incorporated in the budget.
Yeah, and I think when our team have, or we all have a little more clarity on any of the changes that are going to show an impact, we will come back and either talk to it in reference to the dashboard and updates on our financial outlook, or, and if we don't know much, are going to have certainty around many things before we get into the budget conversation, and we'll make sure we include them in the budget conversation for 26, which we would still reference kind of where we target the land in 25. Right. That's still the basis of what we're going to build the 26 budget from.
Okay. Whether the way things are aligned, I think it's going to be a while before
Anything else on the governance planning calendar?
I don't
know. Is there any further business to come before the board? Hearing none, it is 11:36 and our meeting is adjourned.